Now call the case of number 20-11568, James River Insurance Company versus Ultratech Special Effects, Inc. All right, looks like all counsel is present. We have Mr. Ryder for the appellant, and you have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Again, my name is Jack Ryder on behalf of James River Insurance Company. Your Honors, this entire issue, of course, revolves most centrally around policy language. And the key component in any time one is evaluating whether or not there's coverage or not rests with clear and unambiguous policy exclusions. Here, Your Honors, we have a commercial general liability policy that contains a special endorsement that explicitly supersedes general policy terms. That policy endorsement says, this endorsement changes the policy. Please read it carefully. And then provides the following modification. It says under that special endorsement, this insurance does not apply to any claim, suit, cost, or expense arising out of bodily injury to any employee of any insured arising out of in the course of employment by any insured or performing duties related to the conduct of any insured's business. And Your Honors, Ultratech's broker expressly advised Ultratech at docket entry 69-1 at pages 5 and 11 that the policy they were acquiring contained this potential uninsured exposure. So this was not a surprise, the notion that this was a specifically negotiated and included and described uninsured potential exposure based upon the employee of
Mr. Ryder. Yes, if we were here and we were on a blank slate and we were deciding on our own, and the sole question was how to interpret the language that you just read from the endorsement, I'm pretty sure that I, and again, I only speak for myself, would agree with you. But that's not the posture that we are in. We're in a posture where we are sitting on a court, giving our best guess to what Alabama law would interpret this language. And by doing so, we look to Alabama case law. And here, we look to the Wyatt case. And Wyatt has almost identical language, that's at least the language that you just read, is almost identical. And as to the very language of any employee of any insured, the key critical language, Wyatt says, the trial court in that case said, the term any insured is ambiguous on its face in that a fair construction thereof could be that it refers to any one of the insureds. And as to that holding or that finding, the Alabama Supreme Court, after going through analysis, says, we also agree with the trial court that the term any insured in exclusion is ambiguous. The wording could be interpreted either to mean only singularly any one of the insured, or could apply collectively to the whole group of the insureds. I'm given that language and given that case, I'm having a hard time saying that the reading from your opposing counsel, not from the district court, but from the opposing counsel, that this is ambiguous and should be construed against the insurance company is not correct.
Your Honor, of course, I understand and expected this discussion to revolve much around Wyatt, but I would start by answering your threshold question, and that is, are we writing on a blank slate? Is this court writing on a blank slate with respect to this issue? And Your Honor, I would respectfully submit that this court is, for a number of reasons. First of all, the Wyatt case is completely distinguishable in that the way it is interpreted and the way it is applied, as one deconstructs the case, and I believe that the court, and I will walk through carefully, Your Honor, why I believe this court should not construe Wyatt as controlling the disposition of this issue. First of all, looking at the Wyatt, the exclusionary language, and I believe, Your Honor, that the Supreme Court of Alabama, in this 40-year-old case that has not been cited by any other authority since that case for this proposition, when it looked at the exclusionary language, and if we look at the exclusion, there's an exception to the exclusion.
And Mr. Ryder, I saw that in your brief, and I want to go through all the distinguishing characteristics in the brief, but I've read Wyatt at least three times, cover to cover, and it does not rely on or cite that exclusion as a basis for the ambiguity. In fact, the trial court there isolates the very language, any insured of any employee, of any insured of any employee, or any employee of any insured, and says that is ambiguous in and of itself, without relying on anything else in that exclusion or saying that because there's this exclusion, we have to read this as ambiguous.
And Your Honor, I, as you have read it repeatedly. I too have read this case repeatedly, and I've read it repeatedly, Your Honor, probably more than a dozen times, because it is internally inconsistent. Your Honor honed in on the very language that I had looked at just before we started, and I've looked at the language of Wyatt to try to understand what exactly the court was attempting to resolve. And if you look at Wyatt, as Your Honor correctly highlighted, when the trial court in Wyatt and the decision refers to the trial court's discussion of the specific issue as it pertains to the exception, and the trial court refers to the exception, the appellate court, of course, in the Alabama Supreme Court, was only, I believe, resolving the issue that was presented to it. And when it talks about the language of any current, any employee of any insured, and it states it sort of in a broader sense, it didn't say that that was a per se ambiguous provision. I believe that that case and the decision of the Supreme Court, that language was really tied back into the exception. More to the point, if we look at the relevant policy language, particularly the question is, you know, in Wyatt, the language used in Wyatt says any insured in two different ways. And that's part of the dilemma. First, it's to describe the exclusion from coverage as applying to any insured. And then in the exception, uses it to describe the any insured as if it was other than the named insured. And I believe that I look at Wyatt and I agree with the decision in Wyatt, because the Wyatt, the language of the policy exclusion juxtaposed with the exception in Wyatt is completely inconsistent.
I just don't see how the court based it on what the your on the ambiguity that you seem to be relying on and identifying. It suggested that it was ambiguous. It says on its face. It literally says on its face.
But you're yes,
sorry.
Your
go ahead.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor, that the language of Wyatt creates confusion.
But well, let me ask you this. So let's fast forward to another case that's cited by your opposing counsel in brief, and that's Wilson. Wilson doesn't have any insured, but it has an insured. And as you pointed out in your brief, any and an is often read the same way in these insurance cases. Wilson also seems to suggest that there's an ambiguity, and I'll read from Wilson. Wilson, the question of Wilson was whether an exclusion as to claims of injury made by an employee of an named insured operated to exclude a claim made against an additional insured claiming coverage under the policy if the insured is an employee of any insured under the policy. The court, after going through an analysis, including the severability clause, says the addition of this clause, the severability clause, does not eliminate the ambiguity that exists in the exclusion where there are multiple insured and the insured party is an employee of one or some, but not all. The ambiguity in the exclusion remains whether or not the policy contains the severability clause. How is that not, it doesn't cite Wyatt, you're right, but that seems to be consistent with the holding of Wyatt.
Your Honor, I disagree somewhat, because I don't think that the language construed there is exactly the same as the language here, because, and the reason I say that is because if we look at the any employee of any insured language here, and we juxtapose that with the separation of insured provision, and we look at those two together,
But Wyatt doesn't look at them together, and Wilson says we don't have to look at them together because it's ambiguous, again, on its face.
But Your Honor, I understand the court's point, but I don't think that Wilson clearly and specifically said that this is a per se unreasonable, ambiguous exclusion when I would submit that the language is clear and unambiguous under very specific rules of construction. And I think, Your Honor, for example, I mean, we cited, for example, to the Holcim decision, a district court decision out of the District Court of Alabama, where Judge Steele talked about the intensive research he had personally done and found no case that dictated or controlled the issue that he was confronting.
You agree he didn't mention Wyatt or Wilson, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe that's because Wyatt and Wilson don't control the outcome. And that's because I believe that these cases have to be, I would submit, construed in connection with the facts presented in those cases. And that's why I think cases like Holcim, and the various cases we've cited that discuss this issue, talk about the idea that when you look at whether or not a policy provision is unambiguous or ambiguous, I believe it has to be tied to the facts of that case and has to be tied to the language of that policy. Here, that's why I submit that Wyatt doesn't control, because the exception to the exclusion can't be divorced, can't be disconnected from the overall interpretation of the application of the case. That's why I believe it hasn't been cited in 40 years. That's why I believe it's not controlling. You know, we also cited, and I would note, the district court in this case didn't apply Wyatt or Wilson. The district court in this case agreed with our position that on its face, the language of the any employee of any insured was unambiguous and would have controlled the disposition of the case. And yet the district judge decided to look to Florida law through this court's decision in design build. And as we've cited through supplemental authority, even Florida has now shifted gears on this issue through the recent case of the Aiello case out of the Fourth District Court of Appeal, where even in Florida, there's been this receding or retreating, as distinguished from the Fifth District's decision in Premier, from this notion that the separation of power of severability of insureds provision can create an ambiguity or can.
Let me ask you. You're over your time, and yes, if Judge Pryor doesn't mind, I have a question about jurisdiction I'd like to ask him.
Yes.
So I was on the panel, the jurisdictional panel in this case, and I'll just tell you, I am reconsidering the order that we issued. So before you sit down, I just want you to address why you think that the district court's order here on the declaratory judgment issue is more akin to a preliminary injunction than just your standard declaratory judgment.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I would say, first of all, that while the court independently examines jurisdiction, I would just note, and I'm sure my opposing counsel will also note, that they have withdrawn their challenge to this court's jurisdiction. So I do want that to be noted for the court. So both sides do agree at this stage with the court's prior conclusion that under the precedent of this court, that there is in fact jurisdiction. Your Honor, I believe that this court was correct in concluding that there is jurisdiction over this matter in light of the fact that this is in the nature of an injunction in that it required James River to continue to defend and to pay defense costs. I think it falls directly and squarely within this court's precedent.
And so where does it say that? I guess that's the thing. I mean, and now that I've looked at the district court's declaratory judgment a little bit more carefully, where does it specifically direct the insurance company to continue doing anything?
Well, what it did find was that there is a duty to defend, and James River is in fact defending. So I understand,
one of the odd things to me is you filed the lawsuit asking for a declaratory judgment on this issue. And so that was a counterclaim, but the district court ruled on your claim for declaratory judgment. It seems kind of odd to me to say that the district court inherently enjoined you to do something on your own request. What do you think about that?
I think, Your Honor, that once the district court issued a declaration that found that James River had a duty to defend, that has in effect like an injunction, because the James River was going to respect and honor the decision of the district court until.
But we've said that just because it's a declaratory judgment doesn't mean it's necessarily an injunction, right? And so there has to be something different about the declaratory judgment to say it's the equivalent of an injunction. I guess my question is, what is different about this declaratory judgment that sort of makes it injunction-like?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I don't know that what I would submit is that I don't know that it's a difference from a typical declaratory judgment, other than it is a natural consequence of the declaration that the requirement that James River exercise this duty to defend is in effect an injunction unless and until this court reverses that decision. Because, point in fact, James River continued to honor that obligation in accordance with that court's direction.
Is the answer to Judge Brasher's question that the order itself, not just the summary judgment order, but the order that followed it, didn't just declare something, but in fact ordered something, right?
I agree with that completely, Your Honor.
What did it order James River to do?
Well, I think the order, by point of fact, was that it had this duty to defend. Now, I'll acknowledge I don't have the order directly in front of me to read from it, Your Honor.
I actually do. It's on page 2 of Docket Entry 170, which states accordingly. So it goes through and says they're granted. Accordingly, the court orders in bold and capital letters as follows: James River has a duty to defend UltraTech, MST, and Mike Thuin. I'm sorry if I pronounced that incorrectly. in the underlying state court lawsuits. It does not have a duty to defend Mr. Holland, Mr. Moore, and Mr. Anthony, and James River is not entitled to reimbursement for defense costs for defending the insured. Let me ask you this, if you had violated that order, if you had decided, hey, you know what, we're ordered to do it, we ain't gonna do it. We think our reading is right and we're gonna win when it comes trial time and we don't have to do it. Do you think you would have been subject to contempt?
I do believe so, Your Honor, I do. And I believe that makes it mandatory in its effect. So I think that would be consistent with the idea that this court does have jurisdiction over the matter, Your Honor. And before, I know I'm deep into my rebuttal time. And so if I may, just before I sit down, I do want to just reference back to the merits of our point, because I want to have an opportunity to address it if I have some rebuttal time. We also cited to the American Cast Iron Pipe case. And I think it's important that that case too did not cite Wyatt when it talked about the fact that the separation of insureds provision does not create a severance of insured's interest between a corporation and a wholly owned subsidiary. So I also wanted to bring the court's attention to that issue, which we highlighted in our brief, and I think also highlights the fact that we're dealing with a different kind of situation here. And so I know, like I said, I'm into my rebuttal time. I hope that Your Honors, I would ask that I have some rebuttal time still, but we believe that this policy provision is clear and unambiguous. And this court, I submit, Your Honors, this case really warrants certification to the Alabama Supreme Court, because I respectfully submit that Wyatt is just not clear.
Mr. Ryder, you are now eating into your rebuttal time. Thank you may Your continue Honor, if you wish.
No, Your Honor, I just asked that the court certify this case to the Alabama Supreme Court.
Thank you. Counsel for Appellees, you may begin when ready.
Presiding Judge Pryor, Associate Judges, may it please the court. My name is Richard Riley, and I represent the appellees Cothran, Sanderson, and Wharton. The other appellees, Ultratech Canada and Thuin, have ceded their time to me, so I'm going to be giving the full 15-minute argument. Mr. Nyman, counsel for these other appellees, is present, should you have any questions for him. The issue is precisely as Judge Luck has said. Whether James River's employee liability exclusion, including the phrase any insured, combined with two robust separation of insured clauses, or without those clauses, is ambiguous as the language in the policies at issue in the Alabama Supreme Court's decision in Wyatt, McCormick, and Wilson. Judges of this court, James River's language is more ambiguous than in all those cases. Judge Kahlon got it right. The exclusion does not apply. James River has a duty to defend. The Alabama Supreme Court informed everybody, including liability insurers, decades ago, that using the words any insured in an employer's liability exclusion is ambiguous as a matter of law, regardless of whether it's coupled with a separation of insureds clause. All persons, including liability insurers doing business in Alabama, are charged with knowledge of the law. James River should have been well prepared to exclude claims like this if it really wanted to. No liability insurer who has read those cases could expect to defeat coverage in Alabama under these circumstances.
Let me ask you, Mr. Riley, let me ask you this. One of the questions I had for myself would be, if I were an insurance company and I did want to exclude this potential liability from my contract, what would I say in light of what Alabama law has said? How would you write that? The reason I'm asking that is that I want to make sure that the way you're reading Alabama law is not a way in which it would prohibit an insurance company from drafting something that would exclude this liability.
Yes, Your Honor. I think there's many ways that they could have done it. I've got a couple of options for the court as far as language, but I think the first thing is, instead of calling it an employer's liability exclusion, maybe you call it a named insured's exclusion. Another thing is you specifically say the separation of insured's clauses doesn't apply. In this case,
that doesn't answer Judge Brasher's question, because your argument and one that I tend to agree with is that Wyatt says on its face the exclusion, even outside of and not considering the severability provision, is ambiguous. So I join Judge Brasher in his question. if you can't say any insured and any employee, and that doesn't mean what it actually says, what can you say to get there?
Yes, Your Honor. One thing you could say is this policy provides no coverage for a claim asserted by an employee of a named insured against, number one, the same named insured, or a different named insured that is not his or her employer. That is very, very specific. It says that the employee of a named insured cannot sue her employer and cannot sue any other named insured, regardless of whether that person's employer. I also think it's important to specify the separation of insured clause does not apply to this exclusion. The whole purpose of a separation of insured clause is to broaden coverage and to inform business people that, these other named insureds, our employees can sue them or vice versa. I think that's the plain meaning of what a business person would read this. Another option is, regardless of what the separation of insureds provision state, this policy provides no coverage for a claim asserted by an employee against, one, his or her employer that isn't insured, or two, a parent, sister, or subsidiary company of his or her employer, regardless of whether that person is a named insured. That would be very clear language that any insurance company who reads these cases, which are very clear to me, could have excluded the claims in this case, and James River did not do it. I want to turn to a couple of comments made by opposing counsel. Opposing counsel, along with Judge Luck, along with everybody, has read Wyatt numerous times. And opposing counsel says that Wyatt is internally inconsistent. Well, if that's the case, if that's what, and I don't agree with that, but if that's what James River believes, it should have distanced itself in all the ways it could have that was presented in Wyatt. It should have done a much better job than diving in and doing exactly what I would submit Wyatt forbids. A couple of other cases that were discussed, the ASIPCO case. And I addressed this, appellees filed two separate briefs. I addressed this on page 22 through 24 of our brief. But ASIPCO didn't even deal with an employer's liability exclusion. It dealt with a different exclusion altogether, a completed operations exclusion. And in that case, the insurer was trying to use the separation of insureds clause as a sword to defeat coverage, instead of recognizing that it's designed to be a shield to protect insureds coverage. And the issue was not as broadly as James River has argued, that it just means that parent companies are always excluded under employers' liability exclusions. That's not the case. It was a very specific analysis of the completed operations exclusion. Judge Steele's decision in Holcomb, was discussed, that, Wyatt and Wilson was not mentioned in that case, and that maybe Judge Steele knew about those cases but decided not to put them in there because he didn't believe that they're pertinent. That just goes against everything I know about Judge Steele. Judge Steele is perhaps one of the most detail-oriented district judges that I've ever encountered. He is very thorough. He says what's on his mind.
Didn't he note in that case that he got pretty shoddy briefing from the parties?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. He was frustrated, especially on that issue. He didn't get any briefing on that issue at all. And, if he had, I think Judge Steele would have certainly resolved that case differently. The notion that Judge Kahlon did not rely on Wyatt is respectfully reading something into his opinion that's just not there.
Well, counsel, I think it's fair to say he clearly relied on Wyatt and clearly knew about it. But he did pretty clearly state that his belief was that this language was unambiguous. And I have to say, if you put me again, I'll start to say to you what I started saying to Mr. Ryder, which is, If you put me in a complete blank slate here, it is hard for me to say that this is not unambiguous. I don't think I've ever seen the term any interpreted in the way that the Alabama Supreme Court interpreted it here, but it did. But I'm not sure that you can rely on the district judge here who specifically found, even knowing about Wyatt, that this language was unambiguous, right?
Well, Your Honor, I have two responses to that. Number one, Judge Kahlon can be affirmed for any reason in the record, even if he made a mistake about how he got there, okay? So that's number one. I have three. Number two, as you said, Wyatt is Wyatt is Wyatt. Wyatt says what it is. Number three, I would submit to you that this phrase, this use of the word any, is not as clear with respect to Your Honor as it appears. The dictionary gives many definitions for the word any. I've got four.
I will tell you, counsel, our court and the Supreme Court have legions of cases where we've said any is a powerful and broad word and sweeps everything in. It means all of what follows. That doesn't mean in context it can't mean something else. And maybe that's what the Alabama Supreme Court was trying to say here. But I will just say I'm absent Wyatt and Wilson. I'm unconvinced that this can be read, at least without the severability clause. I'm saying, you know, independently as the Alabama Supreme Court has read it. But, you know, we're bound by what it said.
Yes, Your Honor. The move to the issue of certification to the Alabama Supreme Court that was mentioned by Mr. Ryder. Number one, the standard for certification is high, both in this circuit and in the Alabama Supreme Court. The Alabama Supreme Court said in 2011, in the Stewart Title case, 83 Southern 3rd, 469, this court may answer questions from federal courts only where there are no clear controlling precedents, and the answer to the question is determinative of the cause. Construing an insurance policy treads no new ground under Alabama law. And a precedent determinative of such an analysis is well settled. This honorable court in the Rome case also said that comity considerations are low in cases, for example, the interpretation of a clause of an insurance contract. I would also submit to your honors that if James River's quest in pursuing this deck action was to challenge Wyatt as being incorrect, they could have filed this case, this declaratory judgment case, in Alabama state court. We've got many Alabama citizen defendants. If that was its quest, it should have done that. But James River didn't even mention Wyatt in its motion for summary judgment in his briefings until the defendants, my clients and Mr. Nyman's clients, brought it up. And even then they said, well, Alabama law doesn't even apply. They said Ohio law applied, an argument that they have dropped on appeal. So for Mr. Ryder to suggest that this court should, you know, not decide this case when James River has asked the federal courts to get involved just adds more delay, quite frankly, to a case that's over 6 years old. Amy has been dead for 6 years. McKenna has been significantly burned for 6 years. It's been very complicated. We have many defendants. This is the third DEC action. We've had an interlocutory appeal to the Alabama Supreme Court. My clients are requesting your court to answer this decision now based on Wyatt and Wilson.
Can you address the jurisdictional issue?
Yes, Your Honor. I will say that, you know, we did file a motion to dismiss. However, that was at the moment in time when we were pushing for the underlying cases to be tried. We didn't want any more delay. We felt this is a clear issue. You know, we felt like the decisions leaned in our favor, and so we made the argument. Your Honors now know that the situation has changed. We want this honorable court to rule on this issue. You know, the decisions quite frankly, if we just had to deal with the National Union versus Saleen case, you know, I might feel differently about the jurisdiction argument, but the Addison case, the 2017 case, which is not binding, it's a federal appendix case. It tends to support what I believe to be Judge Luck's view that this was an order. This was an admonition by Judge Kahlon. And, you know, let's face it, you know, James River asked for a ruling on this. They didn't want to defend anymore. And Judge Kahlon says you have a duty to defend. So it is, even though it may not be explicitly an injunction, it is certainly a strong admonition. And I think Mr. Ryder was correct when he said that arguably they could be subject to.
Let me ask you, you do this kind of stuff all the time. And I have a question that's a little bit related to the jurisdictional question that has been bothering me for the last 2 years. Which is there's a sort of a split in the courts, certainly in Alabama, the district courts, about what to do when you get one of these declaratory judgment actions filed by an insurance company where they seek a declaratory judgment on duty to defend and then declaratory judgment on indemnification. And some judges, me, I just dismissed the duty to indemnify and said it wasn't right and then ruled on duty to defend. And other judges like Judge Kahlon has held the duty to indemnify issue, preventing the finality of a judgment.
Stated.
Right, so we just state it. So that's what prevents the finality. If you had just dismissed it, then we'd have a final judgment. We wouldn't have any trouble. From your having litigated a number of these issues and having been involved in those kind of declaratory judgment actions, what's your general position on whether judges should dismiss the indemnification claim as not ripe and enter a final judgment on duty to defend, or do what Judge Kahlon did, which is hold it and just basically never enter a final judgment?
Well, my time is up. I assume you want me to answer, Your Honor. I have not really dove down into that issue. I think a judge could do either because we don't really have a res judicata issue. A declaration can always be brought up on the indemnity issue at another time. And so that dismissal of the indemnity would be, you know, without prejudice type thing. I tend to think that it could be done either way. I think that perhaps Judge Kahlon, to try to keep the parties from having to come in in a different case, that may have to get transferred to be more complicated. I think probably he was thinking it'd be simpler just to stay it. That's the best answer I have, Judge Brasher.
Thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Ryder, we're going to give you your full 5 minutes for rebuttal. You're muted.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, in hearing the discussion of the Wyatt case, and certainly understanding the significance of that decision, the fact that so many of us have talked about how many times we've had to read the case in order to try and understand it really lends itself, I would submit, in favor of certifying this case to the Alabama Supreme Court. The bottom line is that the case, Your Honors asked counsel, well, what could James River have done differently here? And that answer seems hard to find because James River did exactly what is appropriate under case after case after case that we have cited from jurisdictions across the United States. The complexity and the fact that the Wyatt decision is 40 years old and how many of these decisions have come out in the interim since that decision and the decisions that have, as recently we cited supplemental authority, a decision out of the Ninth Circuit that was issued after we filed our initial brief, the JJ Realty case, that also supported the position that we're taking. The fact that this exclusion is clear and unambiguous, and Judge Luck, as you noted, when you read it, you deemed it to be, as I understood your interpretation of it, to be unambiguous. Judge Callen, the district judge, deemed it to be unambiguous. He explicitly said, just reading that exclusion on its own, he would have found that it does in fact preclude coverage here in accordance with James River's position. He only found an ambiguity by going back and looking at the separation of insureds provision. I don't believe that Judge Steele overlooked Wyatt. Judge Steele, in the footnote, when he talked about the lack of briefing, as Your Honor did note, he, in the next sentence, talked about how he had done the heavy lifting. And counsel talked about how he knows Judge Steele to be a detail-oriented, thorough judge. So I would submit that Judge Steele, doing his own independent research, concluded, as did the district judge in this case, that the Wyatt decision was not dispositive because it is internally inconsistent. And I think, Your Honor, Judge Luck, as you raised all these questions, you said you had to read the case several times. I think that lends itself in favor of certification. In this court's decision—
Or it could just mean I'm slow.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's it at all. I think that the case is internally inconsistent and highly confusing, and it does not answer the question, most importantly. I don't believe that it gives the court, this court, the guidance that it needs to address the issue, and that's why this case requires, I submit, certification to the Alabama Supreme Court.
Can you, with the short time you have left, can you answer, Mr. Riley brought up a very interesting point about certification and insurance cases and in these sorts of cases where there's at least arguable precedent. Can you address that?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I would start by, I did want to cite in Mississippi Valley Insurance, as this court explained in certifying the question to the Alabama Supreme Court, only a state Supreme Court can provide what we can be assured are correct answers to state law questions, because a state's highest court is the one true and final arbiter of state law. Because we find the resolution of this case to turn on unsettled state law question, we believe that it's appropriate to wait until the final arbiter has spoken. The fact, Your Honor, is that this is an area of insurance law and that there's other authority out there, I would submit, support certification. The reason is because this isn't a case where we're just looking in a vacuum and there's no other interpretation or authority to help guide this court's decision. We've got the Wyatt and Wilson cases, and I believe that Wyatt and Wilson do not clearly answer this issue because I believe they can be distinguished in part, as we've said in our brief, because both referred back to the McCormick decision, which had a, quote, the insured rather than any insured. So I did want to highlight that. Both Wyatt and Wilson referred back to McCormick as if it was guiding precedent on this issue. So what I was trying to suggest here is this isn't a case where the court is looking at it as only Wyatt and Wilson and nothing else. We've got Wyatt and Wilson, which I believe are very, very unclear, followed by a 40-year gap of precedent where there's really no references to these cases, but we have other decisions, district court decisions like the Holcim decision, district court's decisions like this one, where the court dispensed with and didn't apply the Wyatt case as binding authority. So what that does is, and then we've got literally cases from across the United States that have evolved on this issue that have made clear that the any employee of any insured language is unambiguous and that a separation of insureds provision does not create an ambiguity. It does not turn it into an ambiguity. When we utilize the language, we, James River, utilize the very language that those cases and legal scholars talk about using, the any employee of any insured. So when Judge Brasher, you said, what else could we have done? James River did exactly what the cases provide. I think I, again, respectfully request that this court certify this case to the Alabama Supreme Court, since we are all struggling with interpreting what the law in Alabama is on this issue. And again, Your Honors, thank you for allowing me the time to address this through rebuttal.
Thank you very much, counsel. We've got your arguments.